Thank you very much for being here. I'm just honored to be. I'm from Traverse City. I'm honored to be in Ann Arbor, and I've done like this about, you know, I don't know how many times, in the 5 or 6 times, 10 times, whatever. But every time it's different. So I want to explain the book and how it came about. The book, The Good Hike, is about my hike of the Appalachian Trail, which I didn't know. I had no idea how far I was going to go, by the way. But I had this, since serving in Vietnam, I was a combat infantryman in Vietnam in 67, 68. Since that time, I had always, every time I walked in the woods with my children or my dog, it was always, I was always on edge. Palms would get sweaty. I mean, it wasn't the same edginess as actually when I was in combat, but it was always there, and I could never shake it. So when I decided to stop working, be done with work forever, I decided that that's what I was going to do. As a matter of fact, top this, if you're going to, when I quit work in Grand Traverse County, I was the community corrections manager there. The following weekend, I came down to Detroit, went to a Red Wing game. I've never seen the Red Wings play before. That was Friday night. Saturday night, went to a Neil Young concert. Sunday, went, got on a plane and went to Mexico for 3 months. Beat it, anyone. So then, anyway, I had planned for a few months hiking the Appalachian Trail, so picking up equipment along the way, trying to get light equipment as light as I could and try to kind of plan it. I had not camped or hiked and camped in the woods since Vietnam. So the last time I had a pack on my back was a rucksack in Vietnam. So this was going to be different, and I was going to have to get used to being in the woods. And so my son Colin took me down there March 28th, 2009. He drove me to Amicalola State Park in and he said, "Dad, as soon as you want to be done with this, call me," because he knew I wasn't going to go very far. But I had a mentor in Traverse City who had hiked the trail, and she made me promise, if you get on this trail, if you're serious about this, you need to go, promise me you'll go 30 days. You will not quit before you go 30 days. And I said, okay, how hard can that be? I can walk for 30 days. I'm just going to walk and camp, and I can do that for 30 days. Didn't realize how hard it was, but I was able to go 30 days, and I was able to continue on, and it was, the first part of the journey was very difficult for me, because I was thinking about Vietnam constantly, and I was thinking about, like, when I was in the military, all we did was take hills. I was near the Cambodian Laotian border. And so we took hills, and it didn't take long to figure out that, well, what we're doing here is not making any sense, even though I went over there for, I thought, all the right reasons. I was serving my country. I was realizing I started not trusting the government then, because I think they were lying to me about some things. But anyway, I hiked on, and the Appalachian Trail stuff, when I got done, I kept a journal throughout pretty religiously. If I couldn't write, I would just write bullet points, and so I could remember clearly what I did that day when I got back. And it all started off with, I was just going to write a journal, give it to my kids, and give it to my grandkids, and so they could give it to their kids, and so they could see what their grandpa did. And even if I hiked a week, and it turned into a pretty good story, the Appalachian Trail part of it. But I didn't hike just to hike the trail. I hiked to try to conquer this, or at least semi-conquer the PTSD stuff, and about being in the woods and about remembering my friends, about remembering death and dying on a continuing basis. So that all came up when I was in Mexico 2 or 3 years later, when I was done with the Appalachian Trail, and my friend said, "Tim, didn't you hike that trail? One of the reasons, Vietnam?" And I go, "Yeah, well, that should be in the book." So it was in my journal about when I was thinking about Vietnam. So then I just, the book is a kind of a combination of my journey and Vietnam, my journey and Vietnam, my journey in Vietnam. So that's what it is throughout. I mean, there's some funny stories in there, but about Vietnam, but most of the stories aren't so funny. And but I want to tell you, when my son dropped me off at this Amicalola State Park, and he gave me a hug and took my picture, and it said 2,178 miles, 0.3, don't forget the 0.3, to the very end, you know, I walked up. It was like an approach trail. Has anyone ever done the Appalachian Trail? Okay. Have you? Congratulations. There's an approach trail from Amicalola. You sign in with your name, and then you sign your trail name. Everyone has a trail name. There's, like, my trail name was Nanique, and by the way, that's the name of the film. But, you know, the other names, some of the other names was, that I just have a few here. Prairie Dog, Rugged Shark, Solar System, Angry Beaver, Bullet, Blacklist, Privy, Bam Bam, The Three Stooges, Pyrofly, Gritty. Everyone has a trail name. You don't even know the person's name. Colin dropped me off, my son, and this is the approach trail. I have to hike 8.5 miles up to the top of Springer Mountain to begin the hike. So he drops me off. It's sleety, rainy, cold. I'm bundled up. My pack feels like it weighs, you know, I'm 62 years old. My pack feels like it weighs 100 pounds. And I take off. And I get to the top. And when I get up there, I left about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning. I hike up to the top. It takes me about 6 hours, maybe 6 or 7 hours to get to the top, eight and a half miles. I get up on top, and there's all kinds of people camping. And I'm wondering, what's going on here? And so I pitch my tent, and I get some water. I'm eating food, and I sauntered over to this one guy. I said, hey, how long have you been up here? I left about 8:30, 9 o'clock this morning. No one passed me. I didn't pass anyone. How did you get up here? And he said, there's a parking lot right over there. So I tacked on 8.5 miles on top of the 2,178.3. Now, so that's how it all began, and it was like, and my feet are already sore, my knees are sore, and I haven't even started the trail yet. And anyway, the story of the Appalachian Trail, this book, The Good Hike, I mean, it was like, the Appalachian Trail, to me, is like, it was a lifesaver for me. And I'll tell you, the highlight for me was the people I met on the trail and off the trail. They're called trail angels. And you could be walking along in the woods, and all of a sudden you look up ahead of you, and you might see a cooler up there. And you walk up there, what? And you open it up, and it might be the weather forecast for the next 7 days, a Gatorade, a sandwich, and just some people do that the entire way. And it's really, especially down south, really backwoodsy. I mean, I hitchhiked into town to get resupplied and went to the woman at the cashier and said, do you have a USA Today here? Because I want to get a paper. And they're light to carry. And she never heard of USA Today. And so it's really backwoodsy, but it was, the people were just incredibly awesome. So that, you know, coupled with the Vietnam stuff going on and on. I hiked 400 miles alone, the first 400 miles, and I should tell you, I had, you know, 15, 20 friends said, hey, can I hike a little bit with you as you're going? I said, sure, anytime. Not one of them showed up. And because they couldn't wrap their head around it, as they would say. I can't imagine what you're doing. So, but one woman, my neighbor and close friend, Cosmos, said, I'll meet you in Irwin, Tennessee. And she did. So this after I hiked about 400 miles. And she met, and she was going to originally hike 100 miles. She ended up hiking 1,800 all the way to the end. And when you hike with someone, you don't see them often during the day. It's just like almost like life. I mean, sometimes you have good days and not so good days. So if you're really feeling good this day, you might just hike out and be way ahead. And or if you're not having a good day, you might be way behind. But you end up in the same spot, so you might see each other at night. But so she hiked the 1800 and then went back and did the 400 by herself. So that was pretty awesome. But the Vietnam stuff, just was just continued. Like, I don't want to say weigh on me. At first, I was real nervous in the woods, and it just got, it seemed to be getting better and better. And I seemed to be going from the fear to being more grateful to be here, and that I'm able at my age to hike, and I'm able to make it to the top of the mountain, and I'm able to continue on to camp and not be scared so much. When I first started camping at night alone, I was really scared at night. I had my pepper spray here. I had my trekking pole here. Anyone's going to sneak up? I wanted to put trip flares around my area, claymore mines. You know, no one's going to sneak up on me. That's how it was early. And but it just learned. I learned to relax on the trail. I learned to remember all the friends that I was with and fought with in Vietnam. And you know, I thought about them all the time and what they're doing now, and of course all of the ones that didn't make it, and the ones that did come home. How are they doing? I always curious. How are they doing now? When I came home from Vietnam, I wasn't only home like 2 or 3 days, and my friends, I'm from Grand Rapids. They said, "Let's go to Grand Haven and drink some beer and check out the chicks." That's what we used to do. And I said, "Okay, let's go." So we went to Grand Haven. I'd be on the beach for, I don't know, 15 minutes. My friends are playing catch with the football and drinking beer or whatever. And I realized Tim wasn't there. He is gone. And the Tim that left to go to Vietnam was not the Tim that is here now. And luckily I had a friend. I lived with two other guys before I went in the Army, and we dropped out of school for one semester just to have some fun, and we were re-enrolled, but we didn't know that the school calls the draft board and said, "Guess what? Tim's not in school." And so, they drafted our whole house. Everyone that lived there got on the same bus. They wiped our whole house out. And we all survived. One of the guys, Bill, was in the infantry, like me, and he survived too, and so I was lucky I had him to talk to when I got back, and so that was a huge thing for me. I told you a story about this book to me is like it's me. It's everything I ever thought about, everything I did as far as Vietnam and the Appalachian Trail and the good things and the bad things about my personality are pretty much in here. And I want to read you one little story here. I kind of told you a story about when I started, but this is September 15th. I completed September 16th. So on the way, there's these little shelters. They're three-sided shelters, and I only stayed in them like five times the entire time because section hikers and day hikers go in there and they stay in there and they eat in there, and then they leave crumbs. And so if you leave crumbs, there's mice, and if there's no mice, then there's snakes. And so I encountered all those things, so I didn't stay in a shelter very often. But you could go in there, and there's registers in there. There's little booklets that you can sign your name, and you can see in there when you look at it. Okay, well, Rugged Shark, he was a close friend of mine, who I hiked with early. God, she's only like 60 miles ahead of me. He's about 3 days ahead of me, and if I do some extra miles, I could catch up with him. So you can see. So you always sign in. Oops, excuse me. You sign in and. So at this last shelter that I was at, I wrote something to all my fellow through hikers At that time, I think on the Appalachian Trail, that year that I hiked in 09, I think one out of every eight or nine completed the hike. And it's mostly, I mean, most people, the way my mentor said, go 30 days, because most people quit early. They quit at about 30 miles, actually. They just drop their pack, say, I'm out of here, get on a bus, go home, because it's not easy. But once you get your trail legs under you, it becomes easier. But it's still difficult. Anyway, I congratulated all my fellow hikers as to the accomplishment that they did. They hiked 2,178.3 miles, me 8.5 plus, more than that. And I congratulated them for the thing. And then I also remembered, I just want to read this one little thing. I felt so very proud of my fellow thru-hikers who were able to complete and do it while white blazing. You got a white blaze on the tree, that's what you follow. Those strong emotions made me think how proud I was to have known Leo Hadley, first lieutenant in Vietnam. It was July 4th in Vietnam. If I was to do my entire tour there, I had only 8 days to go. But few did a full tour. They give you what they call a drop. They let you out four, 5, 6 days early. I asked Lieutenant Hadley, he was a platoon leader, but then he was promoted to company commander when our actual company commander left. So he was a platoon leader. I had a great deal of respect for him. We got orders the day prior that our company was to perform a helicopter combat assault the next morning. That's when you get on a helicopter and you come in and you're looking to just fly right into the enemy, and there they are, and it's not a pleasant scene, as you can imagine. But we were heading for the same hill that in February, it was like a hot landing zone. In other words, when we came in, when you're looking out the helicopter, because there's no doors, you can see enemies scurrying around, getting a position to kill you when you got off. And it was an incredibly scary day, February 27th. So we were now going to go back there. Here with me, I have 8 days to go. I lost two really close friends that day in February. The NVA, North Vietnamese Army, they were back. And as luck would have it, I was an RTO. I was a radio telephone operator. I had to be, as luck, you rotate. It was my turn to be on the point, the first helicopter in with 8 days to go. Do you think I was scared? I had been here 11 months, 23 days. I felt I had seen more combat than anyone in this company, having never missed a firefight. I did not want to die now. Don't put me through 11 plus months of misery and then take me out. I'd rather get killed right away, you know. That was all of our philosophy, not just mine. Just kill me now. I mean, the night before we departed, I approached Lieutenant Hadley, and I said, Lieutenant Hadley, I've got 8 days to go to my actual out date. I shouldn't have to go on this mission. I've paid my damn dues. I said, please, let me go in. And his response, he asked, Grizzly was our battalion commander. He's a colonel, and he's the one that led us into all the shit, and without ever having experienced it himself, of course. Lieutenant Hadley said, I asked Grizzly yesterday if we could send you back to base camp because you were so short, and his response was, it's a 12-month tour. He goes on the assault. And I said, asshole. I think I speak for my entire platoon in saying we had a deep-seated dislike for Grizzly. I hesitate to use the word hate. I don't like that word. Our opinion was he knew little about what was happening on the ground and seemed aloof regarding the casualties we suffered. When it came down to it, the numbers of casualties when he was our leader, and this is a fact here, was 660. An entire battalion is about 800 people, 800 guys. We had 660 casualties. Nearly an entire battalion wounded or killed. Seemed like when we got when we had a person killed or a couple wounded, a couple weeks later we'd get one replacement. I went that day. I went on the bird, and I got on the helicopter that day, first bird, and I had a really bad feeling. But as we descended, I could see no sign of the enemy. And my eyes were fixed and very intense. We landed with no resistance, and 4 days later, I went home. I thank Lieutenant Hadley for going to bat with me for Grizzly. And less than 6 weeks later, Lieutenant Leo Hadley was killed in action as a result of an ambush. He and 15 others, or 13 others, died on August 14th. Grizzly had sent two platoons, not the whole company, near the Laotian border, and the news of this, of Lieutenant Hadley's death came via letter to my home in Grand Rapids from a fellow soldier who survived that battle. And I saw it then. The war followed me home, and it never left me. I've tried to contact his parents and when I got back, but I couldn't find him. But anyway, enough of that. The Appalachian Trail, I finally, the next day, it was 5.3 miles to the top of Katahdin. Mount Katahdin is the northern terminus of the trail, and I pretty much ran up that hill. It was just so easy for me. I was in such top physical condition at that point. I lost 35 pounds, and I ate. I you know what? I forgot to tell you something. I got to tell you this. This is big. All you do is think of food. Am I correct? I mean, you think about food all the time, so you always need to have a carrot. It's kind of like life. Everyone should have a carrot, something to look forward to in your life. You don't have anything forward to. I mean, what good is your life here? Have something to look forward to. So it was always food for us, and we heard about this place called the Home Place. It was near Catawba Mountain Shelter. It's at the 700-mile mark, and so for 200 miles, we were 200 miles away, but we planned our hike to get to this place called the Home Place, where they, on Saturday and Sunday, they serve all-you-can-eat food, a really nice restaurant. And here it is. The trail brought us into a parking lot that borders Highway Virginia. This is in Virginia, Virginia 311. We sat down for a moment before we hitched. I haven't eaten but a small breakfast today. I was thinking I'm going to cause some major problems from the cook. A couple guys in the parking lot offered to give us a ride in the back of their pickup truck, which happened all the time. I hadn't hitchhiked in 40 years, and I got rides just like that anywhere I went. After being dropped off, we met another hiker on the outside of the restaurant who said he would save a place for us inside while we, you know, freshened up. There's no freshening up. You stink. We committed to eating dinner with him before we knew my friend Mofo. He said that means moving forward. I question that. He was there, as were Cruiser and Doc. We sat in a different part of the restaurant and didn't see them until we were done eating. And eat we did, especially me. And drank. I'd had 2 Dr. Peppers, 3 lemonades, 3 ice waters, 1 iced tea, 8 pieces of chicken, 3 slabs of roast beef, 2 helpings of mashed potatoes and gravy, beans, corn, and biscuits. Then I had peach cobbler for dessert. I was a glutton. I admit it. And we sat for a minute outside the restaurant, you know, just trying to gather myself, and then walked to the general store and bought some candy bars and other munchies and to share with the people in the shelter, which was after we got a ride back to where we were. There was a shelter like 2 miles in where we were going to share some goodies with the other hikers that might be there. And we would pitch our tent by the shelter, by the way. So it had been less than an hour since I had all that food, and I was already hungry again. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, that is, let me say, like, this story that you're about to see, through my hike of the AT, I was able to go back to Vietnam. And I had thought about it every now and then, but I thought, why do I want to go back there? Because there was nothing. The only thing good about being in Vietnam for me was going on R&R to Australia And then when I went to, on R&R to Australia, Martin Luther King got killed in our country. And the people in Australia were walking around the street weeping. And because how could your country kill such a man like that? And I couldn't answer the question. And then I didn't, when I went back to Vietnam, I was only back there like a month and a half. And I was on, we had these little, a little transistor radios. And when I was out on guard duty, there was only one station there, but you could listen to it and you could listen to your radio too. And it was real quiet. And I was on guard duty. We were at a kind of secure fire base and I was listening. And they were doing like a little news thing on Bobby Kennedy. And all of a sudden, it sounded like they're talking the past tense. And then he said, what? He was assassinated? And I went into the bunker where, you know, the other RTOs and our platoon sergeant was. And I, you guys, and of course everyone got up, grabbed their wipe and thought we were getting hit. But I said, just relax. It's got news from home here. Bobby Kennedy got assassinated. And my platoon sergeant, he sat up and he looked at me and he said, so what? They can afford it. You're waking me up to tell me that shit? He said, they can afford it. I tell you, I had a loaded M16 with me, you know. I didn't do anything, no. The trail allowed me to go back, and the highlight of my journey when I went back, I wanted to meet my enemy. You'll see that I do. And I also did a one-on-one with this guy, Mr. Tewitt, who I love so much, and I wish he was my neighbor so I could take care of him. But I want you to look at the film. I went back with my son. I couldn't have gone back without him. Let me say, he kind of talked me into it. He knew, and my kids know, that I had issues from Vietnam, and so he talked me into going. We were going to go, and then like 2 months before we were going to go, this guy that lives, a friend of mine, he's a young guy, he's about 30 years old, lives in Milwaukee, he calls me up. He said, Tim, I had a dream. Yeah? He said, well, he's a designer by trade, and he said, I had a dream that I was a filmmaker, and I filmed a guy, a combat veteran going back to Vietnam. I mean, would you ever consider doing that? And I said, Neil, I can't believe you're asking me that question. After 47 years, I'm thinking about going back now. Now you're asking me to do that. So in private, my son Jake, who lived in Brooklyn at the time, and I talked on the phone, and do I really want to do this? Do I want to have a camera with me and maybe be mic'd at times? When I need to take care of stuff. I wanted to meet my enemy, and I wanted to go back to Hill 1338 and remember my friends. And then I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And with the help of my son Jake, we decided maybe if I do it, maybe it'll help other vets that have PTSD like me. And so we did it. And Neil, the guy that was, he was very gracious, and a lot of times I didn't even know he was there. And it was an incredible experience for me. And anyone, any Vietnam vets here, or anyone that's been to Vietnam at all, the people over there are incredibly, incredibly kind. That's what I was worried about the most. And the horror I felt over there, getting off that plane, so scared, but the people were so gracious to me, and we decimated their country. And like right now, one third of Laos and Cambodia are still cluster bombed. One third of the whole country, they're like little frisbees. So kids pick them up and they blow up in their hands. And 40,000 people have died in Vietnam since the war ended. 40,000. That's just Vietnam. That's not Cambodia and Laos. And not that's not the wounded. There's wounded. It's incredibly high. But anyway, I would like to show you this film, share it with you, and then after I will take any questions about the trail or about the film or about the book or anything. And again, thank you so much for listening to me and being here today. I so appreciate it. Thank you.
For people around Northern Michigan, Traverse City specifically, you've probably heard Tim's name, father, veteran, Veterans for Peace local chapter president, storyteller, and no doubt you've heard that he's a Vietnam War veteran, front lines as a teenager, and you know, that was kind of the story at the time. So many soldiers at that time were drafted right out of high school, as you were. And you have an opportunity that not too many Vietnam veterans have, or that they take advantage of, and that is that you are returning to Vietnam tomorrow. What does this feel like today?
Oh, Colleen, I can't even tell you. I think the main thing for me that is really keeping me going on this is that I hope, you know, with the post-traumatic stress stuff, we can help others that are trying to heal. And so when I go there, I'm going to try to make some peace with former soldiers that are around my age who were my enemy. Jake, he can talk to us a little bit. He's a skateboarder,
yeah.
A very accomplished skateboarder. So he's going to friend Vietnamese children and give them gifts.
Yeah.
And that'll be a big part of it, too, for me to watch him interacting with people that were my age, that were my enemy then, but now he's giving them gifts. November 17th, 1967 was the worst day of my life. That was when we took Hill 1338. We're going to go back to that hill the day after I meet the NVA. And I want to light a candle on top of that hill with my friends here.
Yeah.
And just have peace.
How does that make you feel as a veteran, as someone who has suffered personally from this, especially the moral injury of this special type of PTSD that people are now starting to understand it?
If anyone that's experienced combat... And for me, it was continuous from November through February in 67, 68, to include the Tet Offensive. It's that something that goes away, and it just stays with me forever. I was never free.
Right.
And maybe I'll get a little bit more freedom.
Jake, you are Tim's son. What does it mean to you
to be able to travel with him on this journey?
We've been talking about it for almost 9 months, and to see it all come together and for me to be there to support my dad is like huge.
We got on a regular commercial flight to Vietnam. I was 20 years old, scared shitless. Had no idea what was coming, and I remember landing in Vietnam. I think we were going to land in Da Nang, and the pilot circled a few times and said something. The rumor had it the airstrip was being mortared. We had to land somewhere else. I think we landed in Saigon or something. I don't quite remember. But as soon as we got out, and there was other soldiers getting on that were done, and it was almost like the scene out of Platoon. They were just yelling, "Hey, how many days you got? How many days you got to go? You know, you got a year to go, man." And they're just harassing us and feeling very, 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 very lonely. And even though I was with a bunch of guys. I don't have 365 days to go.
No. Thank you.
Go to the hotel, drop your stuff off. I would suggest not crashing right away.
Yeah.
I end up getting my orders, and they said, "You're okay, Keenan, you're going to go to A Company, 3rd Battalion, 12th Infantry." I go, "Okay, what is that?" "Oh, that's light weapons infantry." And then they were going to send a helicopter out, myself and two other guys. They're going to come, a helicopter. You go down there, there's a helicopter. And I went down there, and they get on. And lifted off, and I'm just sitting on the edge looking down, and all I can see is jungle, and I see no houses, see no roads, see no nothing. I'm scared then, but not nearly as scared as I was going to become.
I thought he was going to go with one of his friends because I know they went through some of the same stuff. But I asked him and he said none of his friends want to go. I don't want to fucking go back there. And I understand that completely. So I just mentioned, I'll go back with you. If you want to go, let's go. And now we're here. And it's insane.
I feel like I need to go back to Vietnam. I've kind of felt it a little bit for years, but not so much. I think as soon as my son was on board, he pushed me over and said, okay. I said, I'll go. I don't have that total disgust with the Vietnamese people anymore, and I want to put that totally to rest. But the NVA is probably the biggest fear I have.
About 2 years ago, I didn't talk to my dad a lot. After that, me moving to Brooklyn and starting to do things on my own, it made me realize that I don't have time in my life to be holding these shitty grudges with my dad. Because the times that I didn't spend connecting with him didn't feel right. And I regret that. He never likes to leave a confrontation, an argument or say just something that he's had a problem with. He never leaves it on a bad note. So there's things that he's been working on for a long time, and that's what we're doing. We're here to make peace with that, and for me to be there for him. We're meeting North Vietnamese soldiers tomorrow. This is a complete life changer.
We did the same thing every day. Two guys dig the hole and fill the sandbags. One guy cuts a field of fire so no one can sneak up on it. And the other guy puts up trip flares in the Claymore mines and then cuts down overhead cover. You cut down trees about this big to place on top of your bunker and then put the sandbags on top so you can see out. You know. Every day we did this. On this one particular day, this is in September, later September, we came to this area. And we came across a couple grass hooches, and the only people that were supposed to be around was enemy. We set up a perimeter around these hooches. It was still not reality to me, almost. And then our platoon leaders send sweep out. So there's four platoons, so you send sweep out in different directions. You just three guys go out about maybe 75 meters or 50 meters, whatever, go out and walk around, look, and then come back. And the other guys are doing the same, so you're sweeping the whole area. I think his name was Rodriguez or whatever. He said, psst. And I looked over at him. He said, I just saw three guys walking back towards the perimeter. I said, well, that's probably the other sweep. They would be coming from that way. I looked over. I heard some noise. I looked over, and there's these three, evidently NVA. They were kind of giggling, and this other one, he was like going like this, and he went and looked at me, and we made eye contact, and he was heavily armed, AK-47, and all of a sudden, this is total reality. This is like, I can shake right now thinking about it, but I just flipped my weapon on automatic and I fired.
Okay. I am Tim Keenan, and I fought in your country in 1967 and 68. I was drafted in 1967, so I got a letter in the mail saying I had to go in the Army, and if I didn't go in the Army, I would have to go to prison. I'm honored to meet you. I had no idea how I would feel today, and I'll probably get very emotional. And you were my enemy, and I didn't want you to be my enemy. And I want to make peace.
Ông nói là ông rất là vinh hạnh là được ngồi đây để mà nói chuyện với mấy anh. Là trong cuộc chiến ông với mấy anh là kẻ địch. Nhưng mà bây giờ ông không muốn gặp.
This is my son, Jacob.
Đây là con trai của ông.
I was around his age when I was here, or yes.
How old is he now?
He's 25, so I was 20.
He's now 10?
He's 25. I was 20.
Ông này khi mà ông 20 tuổi, là ông qua Việt Nam. Cậu con trai ông bây giờ là 25 tuổi.
I don't know what else to say. I mean, can I hear something about...
Right. One by one. Yes.
Yeah, and I want to know, you know, names and then. Tôi
là Lê Hữu Lộc.
His name Mr. Lê Hữu Lộc.
Hôm nay được mời đến để gặp mặt.
He says that now he come here. First of all, he hope that both sides we forgot the hard day in the past. And now we are friends. We have very good friendship. He says that he doesn't want to talk about the wartime. Because he had to fight against the enemy who came to do trouble things in his country. Mm-hmm. No more talking about fighting. Okay. Because he hoped that we are brothers.
How long did it take them to accept the Americans that we aren't the enemy anymore?
Mr. Duke says that we cannot tell you how long did we take to forget the wartime and to accept you are no more enemy. But right now we know that we are no more enemies and we are so appreciated.
Come on. I'm also president of Veterans for Peace in Northern Michigan.
President of
Veterans for Peace.
For Peace.
In Northern Michigan.
Yeah. Ông này là chơi bóng chuyền.
Bóng đá nhá.
Ông này là chơi bóng chuyền. Ông này cũng cầu thủ bóng chuyền, cũng là người bắt bóng. Ông cũng là người bắt bóng và cũng người là tung bóng bắt bóng ông hết. Và sau đó ông này là chủ tịch của cái hội cựu chiến binh cho hòa bình. And we know each other more. And now we go to the second part of the meeting.
Almost okay.
Right. He says before he tell you more details about the Dakto battlefield. He say, yeah, these gentlemen, they were there, but they say they were not the soldiers who hold the guns shooting to you at Dakto, but they was the leaders who told the soldiers how to fight against you in Dakto. He have to inform you very important thing that the man who was the leader of that battlefield directly telling the people who fight against you. So his name is Nguyễn Trơn. And Nguyễn Trơn was the general. This gentleman, he was the general.
He was a general.
He was a four-star general. This guy, four-star general. And the 2nd Division, who was at Dakto in 1967 till 69,
Trong cái lịch sử của sư đoàn 2, người ta chỉ nói tóm tắt của sư đoàn 2 đánh trong. Hồi nó đánh khu vực này.
Just the second division? I was in the fourth division. And then there was the 173rd division. And then there was the, I don't know who was all there, but I know I was in the fourth division. I mean, what they're telling me is just fascinating. I mean, because I didn't know where I was. And they were fighting for, a true reason. I didn't, all of us that were fighting, every one of us,
yes.
None of them, not one person wanted to be there.
Yeah.
And we were just trying to survive to get home.
The time they got here, you know, and I mean, they were like kind of guarded a little bit, you know. I know they weren't even around. No, I wasn't around Dr. O then. And then part two, he said, "Now I'll tell you the rest of the story." We were around Dr. O,
yeah.
And then they were all about love. They were just all about peace and understanding and respect.
They're real people.
They were. I always had the utmost respect for them.
Yeah, but you never knew them.
No.
That was kind of interesting to get a chance to know them. Who are you? I want to know who my enemy was. And now I want to know who my friend.
Their children have peace. And their grandchildren, they have peace. They haven't been at war for a while.
Yeah, for generations.
And how long were they at war before?
Oh, 300 years.
Yeah.
That's special.
It is special.
That's so special.
It is special.
November 16th, we were moving to this place. We were going to take this hill, 1338, because they're measured in meters, I suppose. It seemed like we got up there. It was very quiet for a long time, halfway up the hill, maybe a little bit further. And then all hell broke loose. Before we went up the hill, we airstruck the hill. I mean,
and 500-pound bombs bombing. And then napalm and burning, you know, the jungle. And Agent Orange, I'm sure. The NVA, they didn't have any of that stuff. They didn't have artillery. They didn't have airstrikes. But they would fight us, you know. We were getting beaten back, and so they called in airstrikes again, and we were all just lying there. You're trying to be invisible. You're so scared, you know. And there's a couple guys over here behind that were just lying, sitting by a tree, and they weren't wounded at all, but they were wounded. Their heart was wounded. Their brain was wounded. They were like this, like they were in an institution, you know. And not on their medication. They were just going like this, shaking, like back and forth like this, because they had lost it mentally. It was daylight. I don't know how long it took to take that hill, but because we left early in the morning, it was mid to late afternoon. We dug our holes and sat around. I don't think anyone did much talking about the activities of the day. That's what you don't have time to grieve death. You don't have time to grieve death. You don't even talk about it. We talk about sports. Everyone was the homecoming king. Everyone was a football star. You know, everyone had the most beautiful woman. And we're talking, we dug in. We ended up staying on Hill 1338 for like 2 days. And we moved on. And I think we went and took Hill 1294. And I remember being out on patrol, and they're calling us in and saying that the NVA is back on Hill 1338. So we had to go back. So November was just like constantly taking hills, hills, and hills.
Always remember, the first 20 minutes are the hardest. Going up a mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Hiking. 20 minutes are hard. Then you get into a groove. But
it's going to be good.
It's going to be weird.
You just don't think about it.
I can't grasp it, where I am right now or where I'm standing. My dad was on the ground, maybe where I'm sitting right now, with bullets shooting past his head. I mean, I appreciate it even more. Love you.
I love you too, Jaeger. So, I want to light a candle, Jake, you and I. And let's not burn the jungle down. Although we could probably find our way to 1338 if we did. And here we are, out in the jungle of Vietnam, and we're really not far. In fact, right down there is November, like right around now, of 47 years ago, where I just want to, you know, recognize my friends that were with me. Mike Lawton and Jim Palmer, they were still with us, and they're still alive and well. And Captain Foy and Sergeant Fisher, who got hurt here, Lieutenant Griffin, who died here, and Jim Phillips and Tom Monahan and Schweitzer and Jim King and Tom Anderson and Kevin Corcoran and Ricky Cannon and all the medics that were so wonderful. They would brave fire and do anything to save anyone. Lenny Raguzio and Jeff Baker and Cumbie and Tex, who died later, and Lloyd Slack, my good friend from Grand Rapids, that got killed near Christmas. Denny Leach, my mentor, lost his leg. Jim Nix, Yogi, Thibodeau, the Colonel, I'll never forget you. Joel Holman, Sergeant Andrade, I was his radio telephone operator when he died in February 27. Sergeant Brill, Sergeant Rigdon, Sergeant Forbes, who had the smallest feet of any man I've ever known, size 3. Lieutenant Ernst,
Glass O'Flaherty, who died a couple years of cancer related to Agent Orange. The family and friends. Of all those that were killed in action and or came home a different person. Especially the family and the friends. And to the many noble, patriotic NVA who lost their lives on this hill and other hills, fighting for themselves and their own freedom. And to their family and friends. I'm glad to have met them. They show me much love, and I showed it back because I love them now. That's it. We're sitting out here in the fucking jungle, and I can't believe I'm here.
Hit him because he sprawled chest first, and my adrenaline, my heart was going a mile a minute. What just happened here? But then I made my way over to the guy that I thought was hit initially, the guy that I made eye contact with, and I was crawling over by him because he could have been still alive, I don't know. Or he's not even there. Maybe I'm going to get killed or whatever. I'm scared shitless, basically. He's hit badly. I didn't know at the time, but he was dead. But when that happens, your body jumps around. I mean, it's a horrible scene. You're taught in AIT in training or whatever, even, and guys are boasting about it. Whenever anything happens, you get souvenirs so we can bring them home. So I'm going to get souvenirs off this dude. And I reach and I find this guy's wallet. You know, that's cool. And, you know, maybe he's got some money in here. I can, you know, North Vietnamese money, man. It's a great souvenir. And I open up the wallet. I open it up and I see pictures of his family. There he is with his little sister standing proud soldier, and pictures with his, look like his friends, just like I carried, and a picture of like look like him and his mom. Anyway, I didn't of course let on at the time, but that changed my entire attitude. I couldn't believe it all happened, and I put the stuff back. I put his wallet back. I didn't take anything off him, and then for the next, I probably didn't sleep for 3 or 4 days after that. That was my introduction to that. Does Mr. Tuitt see those other people? I want to give each of them a candle from me, to as just an expression of
peace,
of love and peace. And I want to give you this as a gift from me to you. It says, from soldier to soldier.
Cái này là từ những người chiến sĩ tặng những người chiến sĩ.
From soldier to soldier.
Đã là chiến sĩ.
A bracelet.
Là một cái vòng.
I gotta figure out how it works, so.
Chiến sĩ tặng chiến sĩ.
Oh, here it goes. Yeah.
Họ muốn mang cho anh cái vòng đó.
I should have. Oh, here we go.
Những chiến sĩ tặng nhau. You understand? Mm-hmm. He put the candles on the altar.
On the altar, yeah.
To show up that he respect to the gift you give to him, that is love and peace.
Did you lose many really close friends when you were in the war?
Anh có mất nhiều các bạn chiến đấu, bạn và bạn thân thiết. Many, many.
Một mình là trong 8 đứa luôn.
Just himself, he have to bury 8 other close friends. He did.
How often did you ever get a chance to go home to your mom or your family when you were in the war?
He had no chance to do that. His hometown is in Quảng Ngãi province. Have you ever heard about the My Lai massacre? Mm-hmm. It was his hometown.
His hometown was My Lai. What did he? What did you think of us?
Sau cái trận thảm sát ở My Lai á, thì anh đã nghĩ như thế nào về nước Mỹ?
Cái ngày thảm sát My Lai thì anh không có này, nhưng mà nói chung là anh về Quảng Ngãi, anh xuống thăm và đồng thời anh có viết cái bài My Lai.
So he say when we had the My Lai massacre, he was not here, but after that he came back and he wrote an article about My Lai massacre for everybody to know.
Anyone from the United States, America, did they ever apologize and say, I'm sorry for what we did?
Có cái ông lính Mỹ nào đã cảm thấy ăn năn hối cải, đã tạo ra cái cuộc thảm sát My Lai, ông gặp trực tiếp anh chưa? Not yet, he didn't hear. He didn't see any American telling him something about that.
I mean, can I, I speak for many, many ex-soldiers in saying that I'm so sorry that war led to that, war leads to what we did, and I'm just so sorry. I'm speaking for all of the American people, I do believe, in just saying, I'm so sorry. That should never have happened, and I hope. I know it's gonna. Yeah, I know it'd be very hard for you to ever forgive something like that.
He says that, of course, during the wartime, both sides enemy had to kill each other. He said, why they hurt him like that, and he feel so sad. So angry, but he's happy to forgive because he knows that not only him, but some other people from the other side, they have the same problem. And he wants everybody will be good friends, good brothers, to have the good life in the future.
I love you.
I'm thích anh lắm.
Anh yêu anh.
Neil, will you take a picture?
Yeah, I would love to.
Here, take a picture of all of us. Okay.
Come. One more.
Well, that was my journey. Obviously, you can see it was very emotional. I mean, every time I see it, I've seen the film. I mean, every time I see it, I get emotional. But it was like a, just so healing for me to meet the NVA and do a prairie fire with them. And does anyone know, ever done a prairie fire, by the way? A prairie fire is a shot of tequila mixed with an entire shot of Tabasco sauce. The little guy that was drinking it very slowly, it devastated him. And actually, my friends, before I left up in Traverse City, they said, you better not give any of those guys a prairie fire. You'll start another conflict. But anyway, they were really good about it, as you can see. They were very cold to me at first. When they came up in their taxi, I didn't know what to do, so I went out to greet them, and they got out, and all of them just, you know, I tried to shake hands with them. I didn't know whether to salute them, shake hands with them, and when I shook hands with them, they barely touched me, and except Mr. Tewitt at the end, who was older, and he had been wounded 9 times, and he was having problems walking, and he was kind of having a little bit of difficulty getting out of the taxi, so I kind of reached in with my hand to help him, just hoping he'd let me help him, not only for him, but for me, and he did, and he grabbed my hand, and I helped him out, and then I kind of held his arm and brought him to his and cheer, and he didn't even realize at the time that he was helping me as much as I was helping him, and so I was dealing with stuff, and I didn't even know what I was going to say to these guys. I was kind of ill prepared. I was like a wing it when I go places, but I was at a loss for words, and because they weren't engaging at all to me, and it was really, I was getting really uncomfortable. And actually, the small guy, when they lightened up a little bit, when we did the prairie fire, the small guy, he was quite devastated by the prairie fire. In fact, he got up and he grabbed his briefcase and he walked into the other room and I kind of followed him and I saw him. He went into the other room and I think he threw up. I'm not sure. But then he lay down on the couch and he unbuttoned his jacket and he was lying there. He was sweating. So I went and got a cold cloth or washcloth and put it on his head. And kind of dawned on me, I'm kind of being a medic to an NVA right now. And I felt someone looking at me from a distance, and I looked out, and it was my son, Jake, and he was looking at me, and he was going, why did you do that? Why did you give them a prairie fire? I've never seen him so mad at me. And he's been mad at me before, but that was really mad. Anyway, the journey was awesome, as you can see, and meeting Mr. Tewitt at the end was a highlight for me, and to realize his entire family was wiped out at My Lai. So he was out fighting a war, and we came in and killed all the women, children, and the elderly, and all of them were unarmed. And so that's what he came when the war ended, and we tried to want to come home. He was out in the field and heard about what happened at My Lai, that he lost his entire family. So for him to forgive and be forgiving like that is quite a testament, and I don't know if that has to do with their religion or not. I'd be angry. I think I would be. I don't know how I just forgive. That was kind of what I was worried about when I went over there, but the people were very forgiving. And yes, questions?
Yeah. Up with a mic.
Hold on a sec. Okay, question.
So I'm curious about the reaction of other veterans to this film and your experience.
Other veterans?
Yeah.
Mixed. Most veterans that have seen it, I mean, that look on it, have really loved the film. There's been in Sutton's Bay, it was shown at the Bay Theater one time, and there was a lot of Vietnam veterans that came in there, and there's, for some reason, I don't want to get political here, but the Veterans for Peace has for some reason is a bad word. I don't know why. I mean, we're just a group of people that have seen and been involved in combat and war and want to find an alternative to war. I wish our country would look more at alternative to war instead of the other. And so, but they came in and they were kind of upset. But then after they watched the film, totally understood, totally were on board and were very gracious. At first they were like the NVA. They wouldn't talk to me. And then it was over. They were very cordial and kind.
We have another question here.
Who do you blame more for the war? I mean, President Johnson lied about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, but Ho Chi Minh was willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, perhaps millions of Vietnamese. He was a communist. He could have been a social democrat, but he was a communist. How do you feel about the people who created the war?
Oh, yeah, one thing, before I answer that question, I'll tell you the people, all those guys I met, every single person, they love Ho Chi Minh. I mean, and like all the soldiers, the American soldiers, don't necessarily like our politicians, but they love Ho Chi Minh. Now, I remember sitting on a bunker, and I probably wrote about that in this book. I'm sure I did. I don't think I forgot it. Sitting on a bunker, and I'll say the same thing today. God, I wish after we took Hill 1338, say we were sitting in a bunker, I said, hey, I wish we could get Lyndon Johnson and McNamara here and just spend a couple days out here with us, just 2 days, and see the intensity and watch people die and watch your friends get killed, not get hurt yourself, send you back to Washington, and in a month, if you haven't ended this war or having a good start on it, then you come over here and do your entire tour along with us. And I'll bet that war would end quickly. And I know it would. And that's what I thought about at that time. I didn't know who to blame. I was 20 years old. They don't draft 40-year-olds. You know, I mean, who would go now? I mean, because we think we're more, we educate at 20 years old. I didn't know anything about politics. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what to believe. I remember asking my dad before I went, Dad, I still don't quite know. He was a World War II vet. Why I'm going? I'm going to go because I feel it's my duty. You and all my uncles were in World War II. I can't not go. And he said, you got to trust your country. You got to trust your president. Trust, because they can't tell you everything. Because if they did, people might panic. But just trust you're doing the right thing. So I did. And so I went. And after I was over there, even before I turned 21, I realized this is wrong. This is what we're doing is wrong, and we're just being used. It's like the game of Risk, it seemed like to me. And we're just being moved around, our whole goal was to make contact with the enemy, kill and be killed. And if we got killed, get a replacement in. I don't know if that answers your question, but I didn't know who to blame.
Someone else? Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to go right here.
A trail question.
Do you miss the days of eating a gallon of ice cream in one sitting?
What was your trail name?
Top Secret.
Top Secret. That goes from Top Secret.
No, that wasn't really my question. But how did they soften? I mean, obviously you have to edit the film and so forth, and it was over a period of time that you met with them. What was it, just you mentioning that you were part of an organization for healing and peace and reconciliation that had them soften, or what exactly helped them to soften to you? I'm curious.
That I believe that had to have something to do with it, because I didn't know what to say anymore. At first they said they weren't at it. That Dak Tho is near the Cambodian Laotian border. It's a little village that I was never in. We were in all the hills. We just took hills. We were in the jungle all the time. And in fact, I hurt my knee on a combat assault in September. And when I went on R&R in April, the end of April, or whenever Martin Luther King got killed, I didn't see a female the entire time because everyone we saw was the enemy. But they softened the whole journey was about to end. There's nothing more for me to say. I didn't know what to say. And when I said, that's when I said to Ann, we tell them I'm in the Veterans for Peace, and just see what that does. And all of a sudden, they totally changed.
Yeah, it was a big change. You could see.
And all of a sudden, they said they weren't in Dokto, they weren't, and all of a sudden they were. And they had maps, and they showed where all the enemy were. And I go, oh my God, if I was there during that time, it was harrowing time. In fact, our company commander, who I met up with a couple years ago, said don't ask me why they did this, to his mother and his wife, they sent a letter of commendation to his family that from the 1st of November to the end of February in 67, 68, that our company made more contact with the enemy than any other company in Vietnam. And that was because the grizzly one. And we had some, like all the casualties too. But I think that's what softened them up.
I'm going to take a question over here.
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
It seemed like the soldiers, the NVA, they were kind of just wanting to almost forget the past a little bit and just kind of settle on, we're friends. Did they discuss at all how they as a country or themselves have gotten help, or how they relate to the war, how they've overcome it at all?
They didn't. They did not mention it. I think it has, like I said, a lot to do with their religion. They're mostly Buddhist. And they spend a lot of time. They're very, very religious and very forgiving. And they're amongst each other. Every person my age was fighting in the war. Every single one. I mean, it's not that some did and some didn't. They all did. If you were of age, you were gone. The only people that were in a village are little boys and old men. If you were a male, you were in the military. And so they were all fighting. And so they all had someone to talk to about it. I think that had a lot to do with their healing, too.
So I got one trail question and one wartime question real quick. So the trail question, what was the length of time between the start and the finish? Were you continuous on the trail?
When I wrote the book, I figured out I did 29 zeros. A zero day is when you do nothing. By the way, everyone should do 0 days every now and then. Shouldn't you? I mean, do nothing. Just take time for yourself. And do nothing just once in a while, but we're always so busy we can't do zeros. I can't do a zero. My life will fall apart. But anyway, so I did. It took me 172 days from beginning March 28th to September 16th. My average hiking when I hiked, average hiking miles was 15.5. And when I just overall averaged about 12, counting the zeros.
And the war experience, I really appreciate your descriptions of the PTSD and as it affected you. Can you imagine a combat soldier in any war not having PTSD?
I can't imagine it in some respect. Of course, I can just speak for myself, but I can't imagine. I mean, the guys that I talked to that I met with, there were seven of us, the first time we've seen each other in 47 years, and we're going to meet again on November 17th this year, as many as we can get, but they're all suffering. And in the book, I should say, I met Grizzly 25 years later, or about 30 years later, by chance, and... he suffers more than me because he was in charge. He said that was the worst year of his life. And I told my friends about that when I met him, and I knew they'd be pissed off about it. But my friend met him at Tybee Island, Georgia, and it's a long story, but it's in the epilogue of this book. But I didn't know what I was going to say to him because I had such disdain for him. I hate to use the word hate, but when I met him after this big hullabaloo thing. This Tybee Island's a small little place, and everyone in the town knew that I was coming because I went to high school with this one guy, and he met. So anyway, long story short, we shook hands. All these people around clapped. We were in this little restaurant bar, and then he didn't let go of my hand, and then he took me around to a quiet place where no one was, and everyone went and did their own thing, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he was crying, and he said, "What did my men think of me?" And he was like totally distraught. It was like he was hoping he'd never see me or someone like me again, maybe. I don't know. Because he was a hero on Tybee Island. He was a hero.
What did you say when he said
that? I said, Mike, I mean, so many things are going through my head when I said it, but very quickly I thought to myself, what good is it going to do for me to lay the shit on him? He's a hero here in this little, he's 75, 80 years old now. And for me to tell him what I thought, I just said, Colonel, you were our leader, and, you know, we had a great deal of respect for you, and I left out for your position. And I just left it at that. And I end up seeing him about once a year for about 10 years. And one time I asked him, because we got pretty close, I asked him, what would you do if you knew me then like you know me now? And the guy is so emotional, he just sobbed. He said, I couldn't. That was the gig. I couldn't get to know anybody. I'm a soldier. And he went to the Citadel, he went to War College, and he was a soldier. That was his whole thing. And then I began to understand what he did and why he did it, but I couldn't totally forgive. You know, I mean, he never saw the carnage. You know, he'd come down to the battlefield after you take him off, after the body bags are gone, then he'd come down, you know, give medals to people and stuff like that. But that was it. So anyway, that's what I said. I let it go.
I know there's some more questions, but the library actually closes at 9, and I know people are going to want to talk to Tim about the book and chat with him. So we want to give him a big hand and thank him for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.